Hello, world. Welcome to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig.
Wake up. Did we change the name of the program? To Oh, World, Wake Up? You said you wanted to change some things. Maybe they were changing then, huh?
I guess. Oh, world, wake up.
Before we get into this week's prayer, which has got all kinds of interesting, spicy, ingredient-y kinds of things in it.
Products. We're still doing products.
And a pudding as well.
But just
in case you're wondering, OTM likes to get out and about, and we're getting out and about again very soon. So before we get going with most of the business of today's programs, a quick preview of Portland, where we're headed very soon.
Oregon.
Really curious. 2 years ago, we were in Portland, Oregon. Last year, we were in Portland, Maine.
Right.
And we talked about the story of how Portland got its name, I think, 2 years ago. So we won't do that again. But we're going to be doing some fine dining in Portland, which is a fast-rising destination, dining destination. It seems to be on everybody's roadmap. And, of course, it's in our radar screen and crystal ball and all that kind of stuff as well. So we're going to a great place called Park Kitchen. An exciting new place called Clyde Commons in an Ace Hotel. There's an Ace Hotel in New York, if you're familiar with that, where there's a dining restaurant called the Breslin. Well, Clyde Common is a similar setup in the Ace Hotel in Portland, Oregon. Let's see, where else are we going? Oh, we're going to Nostrana.
Oh, yes.
Where the chef was a runner-up in the James Beard Awards recently, and Laurelhurst Market, where David Krefels, who we met 2 years ago, has one of those things going where he's got a restaurant and a butcher shop right next to it.
A nice guy, too.
Nice guy. We met him 2 years ago. And, of course, we're going to be visiting a couple of the small distilleries, of which there are, I think, now probably more than 10 in the Portland area. And then we're spending 2 days at a wonderful resort in Newburgh called the Allison. And guess what? We'll be doing a little wine tasting.
Oh. And are we going to also explore food trucks?
We'll fit food trucks in at breakfast and lunchtime.
They have a lot of food trucks.
They have a lot of food trucks, too. So it sounds like an exciting adventure, and we'll be starting our report on it, I would anticipate, the first Sunday in September.
You know, I know where Portland, Oregon is. If I think about it.
If
I picture it in my mind, I think it's just west of Chicago.
Hey. Well,
I'm so
yes.
glad I'm married to a geographer.
Yeah, I mean, the
I don't know why. I just have it sitting there to the east of Idaho and the west of Chicago.
The amazing thing is you'd also be figured out if I asked you how far it was from Denver on to San Francisco after you set off there from Pittsburgh, you'd be surprised if I told you it was only about halfway.
Oh, really?
So there's a lot of these old United States off to the west, which is why the advice always used to be, go west, young man, because there's plenty of room out there. Well, Portland is the end of the Oregon Trail. It was settled a long time ago, but it's coming into its own more today than it ever has. Anyway, back to the business of today's program. Because we say favorite a lot.
Well, you're probably saying,
nah, those people say this is their favorite, this is their favorite. They do that almost every week.
We like a lot of things.
We like lots of things. Lots of things make a good impression. But an absolutely incredibly great impression was made on our senses when we came across not a product first, but actually a book. A book about a character called Stubbs who made a career in the food business and left a wonderful legacy behind. And I think that's enough to say before we just go into the interview.
Yeah. Well, one of our favorite products is Stubbs barbecue sauce and marinades and rubs in the work.
One of our favorite products in this crowded category called barbecue sauces and rubs, it has no equal.
Yeah, we love it.
I would say that even if the CEO, Matt, wasn't on the phone.
Yeah, well, we do have the Stubbs CEO, Matt Gase, on the phone. And we fell in love with your product a long time ago, but the last time we actually interviewed somebody about the company was in May of 2007, and a lot, I'm sure, has changed since then. But for those who had not listened to the program in 2007, Matt, give us a little background. Who really is responsible for Stubbs?
Well, first, thanks for having me be part of On the Menu, Ann and Peter. Really appreciate it. To answer your question, Stubbs is a person. We get asked a lot about whether or not there was really a guy by the name of Stubbs. And yes, indeed, he created the company. He created the sauce. Even to this day, we look at the basic formulas for the barbecue sauces. They're born from the original. We look at creating new products, whether they're marinades or barbecue sauces. We always ask, what would Stubbs do?
Now, the Stubbs we're talking about, this was his nickname, right?
That's right. It's his full name was Christopher B. Stubblefield, C.B. Stubblefield, but always known as Stubbs.
And we actually have a photograph with his grandsons, who were part of the company, on our website, if anybody wants to check on OTM and pictures. We were real thrilled to encounter you at the Fancy Food Show, and I would say that your booth is probably the busiest in the whole place.
People like barbecue.
Oh, don't they?
They're everywhere.
Good barbecue.
And Stubbs had a barbecue place.
Did. He did give you a little bit of history on
That's
Stubbs.
What we want, yeah.
He was one of 12 children out in Lubbock, Texas. That's far west Texas. His father was a minister, and he fell in love with barbecue post-services, if you will, when people would gather and eat. His father taught him to cook, and he honed some of his cooking skills when he went into the Army. He was in the Korean War, actually won 2 Purple Hearts as both a gunner and a tank driver, but he also doubled as the cook and was well known for creating chili using the tailpipe of one of the tanks.
No.
So when he was honorably discharged, back in, I think it was 1967, he went back to Lubbock and felt that he couldn't find the sort of barbecue that made him, you know, happy, and decided to open up a little restaurant that he called Stubbs, his little ramshackle white stucco building, held no more than 75 people, and started a barbecue joint that became very famous, actually, partly driven by just excellent food and the sauce that he made to go with that food, and partly because it became a destination for a lot of musicians.
Yeah, it was famous for music, too, I understand.
That's right. Yeah. Actually, it started back in, I want to say, the very late 60s, early 70s. He was just, as I said, it was strictly a restaurant, and he picked up a hitchhiker, a guy by the name of Jesse Taylor, nicknamed Jesse Guitar Taylor, who said, do you mind if my friends come over and play on a Sunday? And that started a tradition called the Sunday Jam Session.
Wow.
And then throughout the 70s and 80s, you would have musicians such as Joe Ely, Thurgood, Stevie Ray Vaughan, Willie Nelson, Johnny Cash.
This is big time.
Jimmy Dale Gilmore, all congregating there. They're sort of under the radar and jamming, playing music throughout those 2 decades. And so you had a really nice combination of just the best barbecue. Stubbs was an unbelievable. He was just, I know people that had eaten his barbecue, and to this day they said they've never tasted a finer brisket. Well, you combine that love for food and these great musicians who are just playing for the love of music. They weren't making a whole lot of money playing at Stubbs. It must have been quite the treat for someone to stroll into that.
Well, his photos on the barbecue sauce bottles, and he looked so authentic.
He was. He was a very, very authentic man. I mean, he's had some very great quotes, if you will. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm a cook. My life is in these bottles. He was a very pure, honest, sincere man. He wanted nothing more than to make people happy and to feed them his barbecue.
Now, he wasn't incredibly successful. This isn't a story where there's a happy ending that lived happily ever after exactly.
No, you're absolutely right. He left Lubbock in 85 because of he just wasn't a very successful business. There are just numerous stories of folks bailing him out. A lot of his musician friends, they dubbed themselves IRS, which stood for Idiots Rescuing Stubbs. And they would regularly come up with money, a fundraiser, so he could reopen the restaurant.
Now, how did the transition take place then? What was the transition from this to the company that you now run and that we've now known for at least 5 or 6 years?
Sure. Well, around 85, he moved to Austin and opened up a restaurant in his current location on Red River here in Austin, Texas. It's a very old building. It predates the Alamo, so, you know, old by Texas standards at least. with John Scott, Scott Jensen, Eddie Patterson, and others who essentially rehabbed that restaurant brick by brick and at the same time started to bottle some of his great barbecue sauces.
And, these are gentlemen who are still involved with the company, right?
That's right.
Okay.
We still have the original founders of the company. Stubbs, obviously, is no longer with us. He passed away in the mid-90s. But he was very close with the folks that I just mentioned and participated in the building of first the restaurant and then subsequently the bottling of his sauces. Both the restaurant and the sauces have grown up wonderful. From my perspective, I couldn't be more excited being here at Stubbs and making so many folks out there aware and of our great barbecue sauces and marinades. But the restaurant, too, has grown. I want to say it's the 22nd largest restaurant or booking, musical booking venue in the country. It holds about 2,400 people and regularly sees top acts playing there multiple nights a week.
Now, take us through the product line, because I'm sure when Stubbs was doing it, there were probably only one or two sauces, but now you have, I guess you have barbecue sauces, and then you have another category called marinades,
and perhaps
there's others that I don't know
about. Rubs as well.
Well, it started with the barbecue sauce. He would bottle in a whiskey bottle, and would actually use a jalapeno pepper as a pork stop. They'd sell the product on street side or farmers markets and events like that. Stubbs was very particular about ingredients. He would say that he didn't want any ingredients in his products that he couldn't pronounce. And we still stay true to that. All of our products are all natural. They're sugar sweetened. We use inverted cane sugar. We don't use any artificial colors or preservatives. All of our products are gluten free. The ingredients are basic products such as California tomatoes and molasses and vinegar and real honey or real Kentucky bourbon if we have that in an ingredient. Real jalapeno peppers. Then Stubbs always said in the secret ingredient, which is love and happiness. Our products are glass bottles.
Where are the love and happiness trees when we need them?
Exactly. No, well, we know where they're at because we take the fruit of those trees and put them in our sauces and marinades. We have a nice extensive line, and we're excited to be developing some new products that I'd like to share with you. But our core line consists of our original barbecue sauce, and that is truly born from the original, and that's our top seller. We also have a spicy that is truly spicy with a meaningful amount of habanero mash in that sauce. And then we have a couple of what we'll call sweeter styles. We have a smoky mesquite, we have a hickory bourbon, and we have a honey pecan. Those three representing, as I said, some of the sweeter product. But a lot of folks don't, we're more known for our sauce, but it's our marinades that we're as excited about as our sauce. We're around the number four marinade brand in the country, and we're one of the few that really focuses on the barbecue occasion. Marinades aren't like the gravy for a pot roast. We have marinades for chicken, and really careful and conscientious about the quality of ingredients. When you look at our marinades, they're heavy in particulates. And for instance, our chicken marinade is made up of a blend of onion and citrus and mustard seed. And our pork marinade is made up of a spicy blend of lemongrass, ginger, and soy. We have a nice spicy beef marinade, an even spicier Texas steakhouse, an even spicier wing sauce. And then one of my favorites that you have to be a real fan of barbecue to maybe understand what it's for, but we call it a moppin' sauce. And I use that all the time. It is a sauce, it's a basting sauce, and it's to maintain moisture and add flavor throughout the grilling process without charring. And it goes great on all sorts of protein, whether meat, seafood, fish, etc.
Yeah, we.
So our marinades are really.
Yeah, we had some of those ones.
We did. Well, I think I particularly like the beef one in particular.
Yeah.
The beef one, the London broil, tastes like something worth eating.
Thanks for that, because we are really excited about that. We're working really hard to try to get our marinades and broader distribution. Our barbecue
sauces
across the country.
I hardly ever see them in the in the markets, I see the sauce, but I never see the marinades much.
And sometimes that's because they're tucked over with the more of the gravy style marinades.
Okay,
so there's a
right.
disconnect. You don't necessarily think of barbecue when you're looking at marinades. And some of it's just because we don't have distribution.
But you do have quite a lot of distribution, because here in Pittsburgh, you're in Whole Foods and Giant Eagle. I'm sure you're in the top lines in the cities across the country. And is there a store locator on your website?
There isn't yet. There will be. We're going to be relaunching our website early in the new year. Put a lot of work into our Facebook. So if anybody's interested in looking up some of we're keeping our recipes there on our Facebook. It's facebook.com/StubbsBBQSauce. And we have a way for folks to upload their own recipes. We have a lot of fun with our website. We have a lot of history of Stubbs, photographs of many of the folks that he's met in the past. But we don't yet have a store locator to help folks buy our sauce. But we have pretty good distribution. Interestingly, a lot of folks think that our top markets have to be Texas, Texas, and Texas. And when you look at our market share, we do really well in New York City and San Francisco and Seattle. We call the smile states, if you will, starting from Washington State down through the southwest, southeast, and up the east coast. Maybe they don't barbecue a whole lot in Manhattan, but when they do, lot of good New Yorkers seemingly choose stuff.
Well,
that's great.
I use it all the time, even when I can't cook it. It's a heartwarming story, I think, is the only way to describe it. And as we said before we came on the air, I'm sure Christopher's up there looking down at all of us saying, "See, I told you so." it's wonderful for us to report that there, after all, is something good that comes out of the state of Texas.
Well, there's some new products coming out, so we'll have to send you samples and can't wait to hear your response. I think it'll be a very positive one. An area within the world of barbecue that's becoming more and more popular, certainly on the competition circuit. If you're going to Memphis in May or at the American Royal in Kansas City, those folks that make a living barbecuing, they inject.
Oh, okay. I've been reading about that. I didn't even know about that before. Before just recently, I read about it for the first time only about 6 months ago.
Yeah. Now it's, well, you know, when I did the Duquesne Club cookbook, he injected all the time. The chef injected all the time. It wasn't barbecue, but he injected anyhow flavor.
So anyway, Matt, once again, thank you so much for joining us on the menu. Please say hello to Rocky and Reggie. We enjoyed meeting them. We enjoyed putting them on our website. You had a great presence at the Fancy Future. I hope we'll see you there again next year, if we don't connect again before then.
We have to come to Austin, actually, because we know.
Yeah, we actually do have to come to Austin.
We've been interviewing all these people from Austin all of a sudden, like Uchi, the guy at Uchi, Tyson Cole, and the lady with Princess Pink Princess Party Book.
Matt may not know about that.
Oh, I know. I know Tyson Cole. I know who he is. So, but if you ever come to Austin, please let me know. We'll have you over at Stubbs, and I'll send you some samples of those Texas our new Stubbs injectables, our Texas butter and our buttered chipotle, and you can try them with your Thanksgiving turkey. We should be on market
before
Thanksgiving.
Okay. Great. Well, thank you again, Matt.
Thanks, Matt.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
And stick around, because we'll be right back after a short message.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And now we're back, of course, and we have two more products to introduce you to. The first one, being from a company called The Gracious Gourmet, was actually the Gold Sophie winner. This is throughout all these thousands of products, the best condiment.
And they're very nice people too.
And they're very nice
great
people.
Gracious is a good way to describe them,
right.
And a good way to describe their products, which are all really excellent.
And then the second one is a Silver Sophie for a collection of salts and the company is called The Spice Lab. Let's just listen to them.
Oh, the Spice Lab guy's got a pretty unique kind of story, too, about not just the salt, but also the packaging and how he got out into the business of doing foodstuffs instead of selling software or something like that, and he sounds like a happy camper. So I'm sure you'd be delighted to listen to both of these new guests.
Today, Deborah Sherman is going to be representing The Gracious Gourmet. And Deborah, welcome on the menu. We're just so thrilled that you got the best condiment in the Fancy Food Show, because it's a glorious product.
Oh, thank you, Anne. Thank you for having me.
Spicy sour cherry spread is the condiment.
It's actually the spiced sour cherry spread, and we're very proud of that product.
We served it with roasted smoked goose.
Oh, that sounds delicious.
It was fabulous.
Yeah. It's a product that's really versatile, as are all of our products, but that one particularly you can do with most cheeses. It's also wonderful with pork or duck, and one of my favorite ways to have it is over chocolate ice cream.
Oh, no, that sounds good.
Now, there's, of course, another way. Try every one of your wonderful products, and that's with a spoon out of the jar.
Yeah. Every product would be delicious with a spoon out of the jar, but it's so important to realize that there are suggested uses right on the label of every jar. And then our website, which is right on the label of every jar, thegraciousgourmet.com. And if you were to visit that website and just click on your favorite product or a product that you've purchased, you'll find easy to do recipes and other ways to use each product.
How did this come to be?
Yeah, that's exactly what
How did this come to be, The Gracious Gourmet?
It was founded by Nancy Wexelbaum.
Right. Nancy Wexelbaum is the founder. She's a fabulous cook. And about 5 or 6 years ago, she was making her own chutney, and a friend of hers, a lovely woman who was in her 90s at the time, suggested to Nancy that she should really market that product. And she was at a time in her life when she decided she needed a change. So she decided to take that friend's suggestion, and she came up with the dried fruit chutney, which was our first and original product, along with a few others. So 5 years ago, we started out with only 6 products, and in 5 short years, we now have 17 products altogether. So it's been a wonderful response from consumers and a fast-growing company.
But the inspiration was just someone who tasted something that Nancy was making just for herself.
That's correct, yes. Yes, she would have her over for dinner on a weekly basis, and then she mentioned it once and twice, and finally Nancy decided to try to market it.
Well, what did she do before, Nancy?
Prior to that, she was in retail business. She owned a store in New York City with her husband called The Gracious Home, and that's for fine furnishings for the home.
So it was just a slight shift. She knows about marketing. Anyhow.
Yeah, she certainly does, right. So she was on the retail side for many, many years, over 20 years. And now is on the wholesale side, but her passion has always been food, and she's always been just a fabulous cook.
Well, this is any indication. Give us an overview of the products that The Gracious Gourmet has.
Oh, sure. We have a number of products. We have a couple of chutneys, a couple of pestos. We have some spreads and tapenades, and it's kind of an equal balance between some savory products, which would be our tapenades and pestos. And on the sweet side, we have our spreads and chutneys. And as I say, we have 17 altogether, and she's always working on something new. We have another one that's just coming out. That's going to be a seasonal product just arriving on the market next month, and it's going to be available for the fourth quarter and the holidays. It's called our cranberry orange spread, and it was introduced at the Summer Fancy Food Show in D.C., and everyone that tasted it was really raving about it. So we're excited about that one, too.
Yeah, that was just too late to be entered to win, I guess, because you only just released it.
Yes, that's right. So we were counting on the Spice Sour Cherry Spread, and as you know, it won the Gold Sophie Award, so we're thrilled.
Yeah, I mean, I forget the exact numbers, but the number of people competing for that award was huge.
Yes, it was. Yes.
There's thousands.
Yes, and all great products as well. So we were up against some tough competition, that's for sure.
Now, since you're in charge of marketing, what ways do you market it? It's
available on your website?
It is available on our website, and other than that, we sell to retailers across the country, and we help our retailers promote the products with shelf talkers and providing them with demo jars so that they can sample out the products to their customers, because tasting certainly sells this line. And
right, it does.
And once the consumer tastes it, they get an idea of the high quality of the product and the ingredients that are used in these products.
Are you Canadian?
I am not Canadian, no.
Oh, because you said out.
No, we had a Canadian on the other day, and she ended every sentence with A as well.
Hey. Oh! I traveled to Canada a couple of times, so I understand that. But
now, your distribution is pretty wide, and there is a retailer locator on the website, I know, because I looked just before we came on the air.
Wonderful.
And local listeners, you're going to have to go lobby your Giant Eagle or Whole Foods, because there isn't anything listed in Pittsburgh, but there certainly is in many parts of the state, and I'm sure that's true across the country as well.
Right, that is true. As you said, you can go on the website and click on your state and then see which retailers are carrying it. But we're constantly looking to, especially in your Pittsburgh area and other areas where we don't have that much representation, and that would be my responsibility to kind of find the right stores in that area.
Well, we have Whole Foods.
Sure, and we are working on that, I can tell you. And sometimes the stores find us, so that's exciting, too.
Now, aren't you excited about people finally discovering that pesto can be something besides basil? What all kinds? Did you see Sauvergne that had all the different pestos?
I didn't see that, but we're excited that people are understanding how easy these products makes it easy and less time-consuming for them to cook a great meal. Saves a lot of time, and our products are all natural, which we're really proud of. We don't use a lot of sugar or sodium or oil, so you can have a nice, healthy meal in not a lot of time.
Now, you're in Connecticut?
Yes, that's right. Our home base is Bridgewater, Connecticut.
Which is?
Which is in the northwest corner of the state.
Okay, so it's out in the country. It's sort of out towards Springfield, Massachusetts, I guess.
Yes, it's about, I would say, about 90 minutes south of Springfield, Massachusetts.
Okay.
Litchfield County, Connecticut, which is a quiet corner of the northwest hills in Connecticut.
And the products are manufactured right there?
Yes, that's correct.
Oh, that's wonderful. Isn't that nice to hear business being done the American way?
Well, you know, it's exciting because when I say the products are manufactured here, the idea for the products Nancy comes up with in her own kitchen here, and then when she has to go and make them in bulk, 500 pounds or more, she actually, they're made in a facility in your state of Pennsylvania.
Oh, I see. Okay, so the research is done up there, and then you have a factory that actually produces in quantity for you.
That's correct, yes. We come up with the, the small batch here, right here in the kitchen, and perfect it. And then when we go to bulk produce, it is done in Pennsylvania.
Well, of course, it would have to be better if it's made in Pennsylvania.
That's what I hear, yes.
Deborah, when do you get involved in the product? I mean, do you get to taste early on? Or?
I do. You know, Nancy's great that way because we're a small company. There's only myself and another woman here in the office. And she listens to our feedback, the whole process, from start to finish. She asks our opinion, she lets us taste it, and we go back and forth that way. And it's nice that she values our opinion. And then we have, in the final process, we're lucky because we have a food technologist who is located out on the West Coast. And once we give her our ideas, she kind of finalizes everything.
Huh, and that's how it goes.
Yes.
Interesting. I often imagine there are a lot of people who wake up in the middle of the night with an idea for a product.
I'm sure.
Always keep a pen and paper handy right next to your bed in case you have a good idea in the middle of the night.
Well, it's true, and there is a lot of backwards and forwards on it, but when we finally get the right amounts perfected, it's really well worth the effort. So.
Well, I'm sure the Sophie Awards have not seen the end of Gracious Gourmet.
Yeah, I don't know. Did we taste that other, the cranberry? Cranberry and what?
I don't know if we did or not.
Did you taste?
I'm not sure.
Well, I'm happy to send you a sample if you'd like to.
Of course. course.
It kind of gets muddled in your head after 3 days of this.
Yeah, no, I think we should definitely taste some.
And I will definitely send you out a jar this afternoon, then, if you'd like.
Okay.
I think you're going to love it.
Yeah, and as I was saying just before, it is possible to win gold sophies year after year after year. I have a feeling that this is not going to be Gracious Gourmet's last gold sophie.
Oh, we certainly appreciate that, Peter. Yeah, it is possible. You first have to win the silver category,
sure,
and that qualifies you to enter to win the gold award once you've won a silver. So,
well, Ciao Bella Gelata has won 17 sophies.
Oh, yes, one of my favorites.
Yeah,
the key lime.
Yeah, that's
Yeah, and you probably have a topping to put on that.
You know something? We probably do. Many people use our products over ice cream too. In fact, we have a company in Ohio that manufactures their ice cream with one of our products, our Fig Almond Spread, and do fantastic with it.
Oh, is that the gallon? Jenny?
Yes, that's absolutely right.
Yeah, she's on a book tour right now. We've got her book.
Oh, how wonderful.
Yeah,
Jenny's Ice Cream, a wonderful customer of ours.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and please say hello to Nancy and let her know we're sorry that we missed her, but I'm sure she'll be on the program sometime in the future.
Oh, I hope so, too, and thanks so much for having me,
Ann
and Peter.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye now.
We love our new gourmet salt collection from the Spice Labs Gourmet Salt, and talking to the founder now, Brett Kramer, who has the flu, and I have sort of a frog in my throat, so we're a wonderful match here, Brett. Tell us a little bit. I think it's a wonderful collection. Bring us up to, where did you get this idea? What background do you come from?
Well, actually, I'm a computer guy. I've been in the internet and the computers for 20-some years. Before that, I was free labor for my father, who was a general contractor and a cabinet maker. He had a cabinet shop.
Oh, so now where's that? The wood comes in.
Yeah, so the wood comes in. And I needed Christmas presents 2 years ago for my employees, my accountants and everybody else from my .com company. And I said, well, I need something different. I don't want to spend a lot of money. What can I do? So I had an idea of giving away gourmet salts because I need some salt for myself. I said, well, I'll just order 5-pound bags of special salts in and give away as Christmas presents. And everybody thought I was completely crazy.
Now, you weren't, at the time, you weren't in the salt business at all.
Oh, no, I'm a computer guy.
Right. I mean, you were still in the computer business. Now you've become a salt guy 100%.
That's right. I ordered in the bags of salt that came in, and once they came in, everybody was, oh, my God, this stuff is awesome. Because they thought they were joking with me the first week or two before the salt showed up. I said, well, I can't give it out a little plastic bag. So the idea about, well, let's put it in test tubes, in a test tube rack. So I order in 250 test tubes from Corning, and I go order a couple test tube racks in for lab equipment for, like, you're using it like a school lab. And stuff came in, and the test tube racks were just garbage. They won't work right because if you hold them sideways, all the tubes fall at the bottom.
Which
is okay in school because you're supposed to hold the stuff level, but for practicality uses on the table, it's not going to work. So I said, to the wife, I said, this is not going to work. So that weekend, we went dumpster diving and looking for old pallets. Shipping pallets, because when I was a kid, my dad found a bunch of shipping pallets made out of exotic wood that they were thrown away, and we made picnic benches out of them. In fact, I still have one in my patio right now. It's beautiful mahogany, that's scrap wood.
Oh, great.
So I go dumpster diving, and I find some wood, bring it back, drill some holes in it, and put the tubes in. It says, oh, this looks pretty good. The trouble is the test tubes are metric, and we're in America, so I had a special order in a metric bit, so drilled the right holes. Went to my father's house in Boca. He passed away 10 years ago, but went to my father's house in Boca, and I stole the sander, and I stole the table saw, and I stole a couple other things out of the garage that nobody's touched in 15 years. Went down, and I made 30 kits to give away as Christmas presents. Well, everybody sees them now. They want to buy them. So this is not working out. So I put them on Amazon Thanksgiving weekend 2 years ago. Well, by the time I went back to work the next week, after Thanksgiving, I had, like, 30 orders. Well, within 3 weeks, between Thanksgiving and Christmas, I had over 120 orders for the kids. Now, that's great. The only problem is I only had enough salt to make about 50 orders because I wasn't planning on selling the kids.
Mm-hmm.
Like, who's going to buy this? I mean, it's a Christmas present. Well, long story short, last year we sold 1,200 kits without trying, and this year we're selling them so fast we can't make them.
Well,
so,
where are you sourcing your salts? Were you interested in salt before?
Well, yeah, I found a couple of really nice salts about 10, 12 years ago in one of my travels, and then about 6 years ago I was in a little country called Slovenia between Italy and Croatia.
And we've been there.
Ah, beautiful. They have a salt works there in Paran. There's a salt works. And I went to the salt works, and I got there Sylvanian salt, and it was really, really good and just great. And I ran out of salt, and this is how this all started, because I needed to reorder some cool salt. And I started researching them, and now we import salt from 30 different countries.
Uh-huh. Do you know that book we interviewed, the author, Salted?
Yes.
It's a wonderful reference book.
There's actually two or three books out there on salt that are really, really well done. Salted's a really good one. There's another one I have, and I can't tell you the name right now. It's more of a technical book about the history of salt and why salt is so popular and stuff like that. But
well, that was
great fun.
It was all over, of course, the Fancy Food Show this year.
Yes.
They're now selling big blocks that you can actually cook your food on, and blocks with shavers, you can shave your own.
Well, that was Nirmal had one of those, right?
She had one of those.
She had a piece of rock salt.
Yeah, but there was more in different companies doing it now. So there's a huge interest in these salts. And I guess my question is, how do you determine, is the field already overcrowded that you're venturing into?
Well, just like with salt blocks, we're now bringing in about one container every 30 days of Himalayan salt. We can't bring the salt blocks in fast. In the last 9 months, I set up probably about 100 dealers around the country. The problem is my orders are outpacing my deliveries about 2-1 right now.
Now, when you talk about a container, you're talking about a seagoing shipping container?
Yes, sir, yeah.
That's one hell of a lot of salt.
What is it, 38,000 pounds or something like that?
It's a lot.
We buy them in kilos, so I have to convert the kilos up. I think it's like 40,000, 38,000 pounds.
Whatever it is, it's a lot.
Well,
I like the story of you bought a whole case from some country in Africa.
Yes.
What country? You didn't say what country it was. Are you not allowed to?
Well, it's northern Africa, so it's a big desert over there. So,
okay,
so what's the story?
Well, he found out about the salt, but they were having trouble getting it out of the country. Yeah. So he said, well, that's all right. Well, I'll just buy a container load of it, and maybe they'll send me that. And they did.
And that's what we're doing with the Himalayan salts now, too, is we're literally buying, we now have orders scheduled between now and 75, 90 days from now. I have one container come in every about 2 weeks. We have a container come in about every 2 weeks for the next 2 months to get stocked up for Christmas. It's just crazy. Everywhere we go, we buy in pallets or containers of the salt, and we're doing really, really well with the products.
Oh, wow. And you're no longer a computer guy.
Oh, no. Well, funny thing was, crazy German guy says, hey, I want to buy your community, your website. I'm like, sure. It took 9 months for the guy to write me the check. Then I had to consult with him for 6 months. That ended about 9 months ago. So I've been full-time in the salt business almost about a year now. Full-time in the salt business.
Now, you're probably still discovering. You're probably still discovering what salts are out there?
Pretty good fuel. I have another 30 coming in the next 20 days. There'll be 30 or 40 new salts on the spicelab.com in the next month or so that I picked up. I have a guy over in Europe that hunts them down for me. These are mostly either European salts or kind of some Indian salts in there, some weird salts from India and stuff like that.
Now, you have different collections.
Yes, ma'am.
What are some of your collections?
Well, the first one's called Collection Number 1 because it was the first 11 salts that I bought and I gave my Christmas present. And it's just called Collection Number 1 because it was just the first one I did. And the salts in there are just the first 11 salts I bought that I personally liked is how that one came about, is what it is. And then Collection Number 2 is where I started finding other salts. Collection Number 2 is, again, a random assortment of salts, which means not by flavor or by country or by theme. There's kind of a random assortment of salts. And that one has a Persian blue salt in it that's very unique. We're like the only guy in the country with that.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen that one.
Yeah, Persian blue is beautiful.
What does it taste like?
Tastes like salt.
It changes flavor a little bit because it's blue because it was crushed underneath the mountains, and the crystal got so heavy, it got compacted so much that the crystals break internally, causing a prismatic refraction of light.
Okay.
So light refracts off the crystals in a blue spectrum. So when you dissolve it, it turns like salt. But when you taste it, it actually changes flavor. They say because when the crystal dissolves, it actually breaks back apart. When it dissolves, it turns into normal salt crystal, and it causes it to change on the palate, and it does. You taste the salt, and about 10, 15 seconds later, it'll have a whole different little flavor to it in the back of the tongue. Kind of unique. Kind of like some of the chili peppers do that, too. The salt does that.
And now, you're not all in gift sets with this. You sell jars of salt.
Yes.
Okay.
And we have 14 different themed gift sets. Everything from the generic ones, like Collection 102, or Collection Number 3, which is our Hawaiian collection. We have 11 salts from Hawaii. We have a smoked lava wood salt in there. We have bamboo jade salt. We have a couple white salts, a couple pink salts. These are all salts made on the island of Hawaii. Then we have like a French collection, or we call it the Old World collection, which is all the salts you would see in France and Northern Italy. We have a spicy collection for the people who like chili called the Chili Head Collection. has everything in it from a mild pepper all the way to a ghost pepper. And don't try the ghost pepper.
I've never tried the ghost pepper, but it was a hot, I don't want to mean hot, but I mean it was really the most buzzy of the, chilies at the fancy food show.
So the Chili Head Collection goes really well with people who like that flavor. We have a barbecue collection, which is all the smoke salts, and like a garlic salt is in there. We have a large flake collection, which is from the island of Cyprus and Wales.
Yeah.
Welsh salt salts, which is the gigantic flakes. Some of the flakes get
like
three quarters
flakes,
of an inch.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, this is all on your website, so why don't you give us this website again?
TheSpiceLab.com.
That's good. And you're also going to be coming out with peppers?
Yes. Yes, we've sourced out about 15 different kinds of unique and rare peppercorns. We're doing some projects this fall for Christmas with a couple big retailers, and then we'll make some of these available next year to the general public on the peppers.
Well, you're really launched and on your way for this Spice Lab thing, Brett. Congratulations.
Well, thank you so much.
It's a bold new venture for you, huh?
Well, yeah, we kind of came about just because people wanted it. It wasn't like, hey, let's go to the salt business one day. It was just, I don't really want to sell salts, do I? People want to, then once you do that, you start talking to people and you start bringing in some stuff, and people call me up all the time, oh my God, thank you so much, I haven't tried this salt since I was a kid, or it becomes this thing where they get back memories of what it was like when they're in the old country, the old world, or when they're kids, or whatever.
Sounds like a lot more fun than computers.
You tell me, well, Anthony, I don't worry about the phone ringing at 3 o'clock in the morning because the servers blew up or something.
Great.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today on the menu, and we'll certainly keep watching what you're up to, and if you get up to anything extravagantly new, you must be sure to get in touch with us and let us know.
I sure will. When I get the peppercorns out, I'll send you guys some samples out there.
Great.
And we'll get you hooked up some peppercorns, and I'll show you that new pepper mill I was talking to you about.
Oh, good. Okay, Brett, thank you so much.
Thank you guys so much for the time.
Bye-bye.
And we'll be back with more after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, everybody, and what's up next?
Well, you know, I'm amazed myself that there's always some new product in the form of a natural item, a fruit, a herb, a new vegetable, a new whatever it is. Now we have a new citrus. It's not actually a lime, but it's related. It's in the citrus family. And I love these adorable little things called finger limes.
I wonder why they call finger limes, not thumb limes.
Because they're thinner. I don't know. I have no idea.
Probably because fingers outnumber thumbs 4-1. I think maybe that's it.
But I don't know. We should have remembered to ask Megan Shanley, whose family farm produces these in California.
I think she told us what she knew, which is. Not a whole lot, because it's all kind of a mystery, but her father's quite a leading orchard grower, because he got some of these before anybody else, and has got just a nice little corner on this fascinating product, which has all kinds of interesting uses.
First of all, Megan Shanley, how are you involved with this farm, Shanley Farms? Is that your family's business?
Yes. So my mom and dad purchased the avocado ranch in 1998 when I was still a little girl, and they planted the avocado trees, and they've been raising them ever since. I graduated high school, went off to college and studied agriculture business, and then I went out and I worked for Driscoll's, which is a berry company based out of Watsonville, California. I worked with them for 2 years, and then the finger limes started producing, and we realized there was a lot of interest there from different chefs and foodies.
Oh, yeah, the chefs are crazy about them. Yeah.
Now, finger limes are native to where?
Australia.
Okay, we thought so, but we're not sure.
Yeah, so if you ever Google search finger limes, you'll find a lot of stuff coming out of Australia. That market's been pretty well developed.
But
it's
how?
A lot more.
When we lived there, I never saw any finger limes. We lived
in restaurants and whatnot.
I never saw that.
Yeah, but
period.
That was 40 years ago.
Well, is it native, and how long has it been going a viable crop is what I'm going to ask Megan.
A viable crop in Australia. I could not give you a solid answer on that. I know their trees are at least, there's some trees that are at least 10 years old out there because the fruit is as big as a normal lime that you would buy at the grocery
store.
Amazing. Okay.
See, I thought they only came small.
No, they're really big. I've seen pictures.
Now, why
really
are they called finger limes then? I thought they were called finger limes because they look like a little baby pinky
finger. No, they still look like the shape of a finger. They're just very
bigger. They're just bigger. Okay.
Really like a giant finger. And these are only pictures I've seen. I've not seen their actual fruit.
So okay. They look like Shaquille O'Neal's fingers or something like that, rather than yours and mine.
Megan, right. Let's establish, first of all, these are a citrus fruit, but they're not exactly limes.
Yes, so it's not technically part of the lemon family or part of the lime family. They call it a microcitrus. So it's part of citrus family, but it's not technically related to the lemon or lime. They call it that because it looked like a lime and it sort of tastes like a lime.
Now, it really doesn't look like a lime inside, does it? Because of the structure of the fruit inside is one of the things that chefs, I guess, are most excited about.
Exactly. Chefs love the caviar-like appearance that you get when you open up the lime, the citrus pop that comes in your mouth when you bite into the little juice vesicles, the pearls that you find inside. Chefs just go crazy over it.
I know. Well, they were all over the fancy food show because one chef, a Korean chef, was mixing it with real caviar.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, it was, I can't remember, the rest of the dish was even more convoluted and complicated.
Right.
But anyhow, so let's get the story. So at what particular part of Australia produces finger limes?
I'll have to get back to you on that.
Oh, don't worry about it. So what gave you the idea, or your family, the idea of growing them in California?
So it was my dad, and he was at a citrus expo show that's put on every year with researchers and farmers come around to see what the new varieties that are coming out are, and he stumbled on the finger lime tree, and he asked all kinds of questions, and at the time that he spoke with the researchers there, the professors at the expo, finger lime trees weren't yet available to California growers. So he kind of hinted that he'd be really interested in taking an order of those trees as soon as they became available. And I think it was just a couple years after that that budwood was released, California nurseries, and my dad got his first planting in.
So it's really a new sensation, isn't it?
Brand new in the U.S. And there's us and a couple of other large growers in California, and that's it.
Yeah. No, so
you would consider yourself fairly large, then?
Yes, we are large with 2,000 trees planted.
That sounds like that's a lot of trees.
Yeah, so that's the largest planting, and there's one that's getting real close to that, and the other is just behind him. So.
Well, now, this means basically that you can order off-season. There's a definite season for it, but if you take Australia and California, then you stretch it throughout the year, right?
Well, I think that's what they do in Europe, but in the U.S. you cannot import Australian fruit.
Okay,
fruit fly.
No, they're considered to, Australian fruit's considered to be quite diseased, I guess, and in fact it really is.
Okay, well, but we can send our fruit over there. So in Europe, they have a year-round supply of finger limes.
Wow.
Okay, the funny thing about Australia is that there are parts of the country which are really where fruit fly and other pests are kind of endemic, and there's really sort of not any way of getting rid of that.
Gosh.
And then there are other areas which are very serious about their fruit. For example, the state of Victoria is very serious about its fruit, and you can't carry fruit of any kind into Victoria. It's just if you have any fruit, you have to surrender it at the border. If you look suspicious, they'll search your car and your luggage to find out if you have any.
Oh, gosh. And the
same is true going into Tasmania, where you fly in. Again, the same thing. You can't take in fruit, and if you look like a suspect, again, they'll search you to get rid of it, because once a pest like that gets in, it's very difficult to dispose of. Now,
yes.
I think the United States is not tropical enough that these kinds of pests flourish.
But, you know, there are all these things that you cannot get, what's the Asian citrus in here, the yuzu,
right.
You can't get it.
serious threat to California citrus right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think the U.S. is particular about what comes in here too. Again, yeah, no. for exactly the same reason.
What does yuzu bring? Why is it a threat to California porting?
The Asian, I don't have details, but I just know that it wiped out a lot of orchards and forests.
Okay.
And then they had traces of it in different parts of California. And I don't think at this point it's wiped out any orchards, but it's a definite threat because of what it's done.
Of course, the Meyer lemon's done very well, hasn't it?
Meyer lemons have really taken off.
They're wonderful.
Yeah.
We
always grew up on Meyer lemons in our backyard, so I thought that's what a lemon was supposed to be, but now they've branded it and created a real market for it.
Before we get carried away here, why are all these chefs, I know the texture, but what are they doing with these finger limes?
That is a great question. I'm always asking. We used to go, last season we went to the Santa Monica Farmers Market near L.A., and we would have the chefs come up and buy directly from us. And we always tried to ask, what are you guys doing with it?
Yeah.
And they would stand there, and they would just ramble several minutes about these intricate dishes and different fish types that they're putting these finger limes on, and it would blow my mind, and I never even understood half of what they were saying because it was so out of my realm of cooking, the things that they do with these. Like, you guys probably know a lot more than I do as a grower about what they're actually in the kitchen doing with these.
What do you do with them?
We actually put them on raw oysters pretty frequently. That's our favorite.
That's
thing
great.
To do. Yeah, it's that richness of the oyster with the pop of the finger lime is great. My dad makes this fleur blanc sauce. Instead of using the lemon, he throws in the finger limes at the end over halibut.
That's nice, too.
Yeah. We pretty commonly just sprinkle it over whatever salad we're using, eating that night. So, like, poppy seed dressing, something sweet with the tart of the finger lime is always really nice. And then I'm a single girl living alone. I'll put it in my Corona beer when my friends come over. We'll throw them on
nice.
Our tacos on taco night. There's just so many different uses. We actually have someone in LA that we're working with, and they are making a finger lime marmalade for us. It's Valerie's Confections. They created a recipe that's really delicious for finger lime marmalade.
That would be great. There is one of my favorite marmalades is made by a company called Roses in England, and Roses is famous the world over for Roses lime juice. And they make a lime marmalade, which is quite delicious.
Well, you'll have to try it.
Well, now, let's not forget, people are going to be very curious about this now. How do they go about getting them?
You can go to www.shanleyfarms.com, and we have an online shopping cart, and the only thing we're selling on there right now is the finger limes. At this point, we're selling them for $20 for a 6-ounce package, and that 6-ounce package has 25 to 35 finger limes in it. And it may seem like a high price, but you really get a lot of pulp out of each one of those limes, especially at this time of the season when the fruit is as big as it's gotten. And then you'll order that online, and we ship overnight, 2-day.
Great. And Shanley is spelled S-H-A-N-L-E-Y.
Yes.
Farms is plural.
Shanley Farms.
I looked it up just before we went on the air, and the website says you pick them on Monday and ship them on Tuesday.
Exactly.
So if you want some for the right day of the week, you better figure out the calendar and make sure that you know you're going to get them when
but
you need them.
Let's also talk about how long they last in refrigeration and on your counter.
Oh, please, okay. Yeah, very sensible.
Yeah, if you put them in your refrigerator, you can hold these limes for up to 3 weeks, maybe even longer. You will notice that the fruit, the outside rind will start to discolor and maybe even shrivel up, but you'll find that the inside pulp is just as vibrant as it was the day you got your order. That isn't affected, but you do want to keep it in refrigeration because, like any citrus, it's perishable. So if you have it sitting on your counter for a week or two, you will notice that they'll start to mold.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, thank you.
Wow.
This is a very, very intelligent and useful piece of information. And
there you go.
We're delighted to find out about this and find out. You listeners, you can get your own supply. You don't have to rely on somebody else to do that for you.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure your finger limes are just year upon year are going to get bigger and bigger, right?
We hope so. Yeah, we do hope so. We hope to start seeing them in retail locations across the country. Right now, the price point is too high to carry them in common retailers, so they're not that accessible for a lot of people.
Yeah, I did once see them in my local Whole Foods market, but only once.
You do
wow,
see
it
and you didn't
Easter?
Bring it back?
Yep.
I've been trying to get finger lines for 2 years.
Oh, my God.
Well, this is a few months ago. I think there was some kind of absolutely totally outrageous price.
Oh, I'm sure.
But they sell passion fruits at $3 or $4
yeah,
a piece.
Yeah, they sell them at a totally outrageous price as well.
Yeah, I mean, passion fruit used to be a wild vine in Australia, you know.
Yeah, everybody had one in their garden.
Because they're always willing to try out these new exotic pieces of fruit that come up in the market.
We went through this with black garlic a few years ago. You know?
Yeah.
Well, it is exciting. Anything new on the market, and you sound like you're having a good time too, Megan.
Oh, I love my job. I could not be happier. I am thrilled to be here.
Oh, great.
The finger lime queen with an infinite supply of Corona and something to lime.
Yeah, I like
with.
That.
There you go.
Corona with finger lime.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today on the menu, and I'm sure you'll keep in touch. If you get another exciting new crop, you must be sure to call and tell us about it.
I will, and you guys are welcome for a visit to our ranches anytime you're out this way, so keep in touch.
That would be fun. Thank you, Megan.
You're welcome.
Bye.
And it's time for another break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And we're back for the final segment of today's program, which is a combination of sweetness and nostalgia.
And you, made you think of your childhood.
Made me think of steam puddings that my mother used to make back home in good old England, but apparently the taste is very similar, but the method of preparation is different.
Totally different.
Totally different. In any case, a Malva pudding sounds like a real winner. You just wait to listen to the famous people who tried it and love it.
What is it that Henry Kissinger, Oprah Winfrey, and Nelson Mandela have in common?
I
that's,
know.
That's a good question. It turns out, clearly I didn't quite fool you because you know that they're of different races, so that's certainly not it. It turns out that they are all huge fans of the product made by our guest in this interview, Kari Mansfeld.
Yes.
Who makes, of all things, pudding that reminds her of home in South Africa. Go figure.
It's called Malva pudding. Kari, welcome to On the Menu. And give us a little orientation here. First of all, what kind of a pudding is this?
Well, thank you for having me. Malva pudding is actually a well-known traditional South African dessert that actually originated probably mostly in the Western Cape. So I have actually met some South Africans who haven't had it for the north, and even some from Johannesburg. But for the most part, it was such a popular, very good, delicious dessert that you'll find it in most restaurants in South Africa, and definitely most of the people there would have heard about it. It's like a lovely, moist, rich, caramelly cake, and you traditionally have it warm with a little bit of custard or a little bit of ice cream.
Now, who was Malva?
Malva, when it originally started, from what I have found out, it started in a vineyard called Boschendal, and Malva was this woman who made it. That was her name, but she's named after a South African flower that's kind of like a geranium, and she made the original pudding, so it was always Malva's pudding, and so as a result, that was the one theory. And I've also heard recently as well that Malva is a word for marshmallow, and people thought that was the texture of the pudding. Yeah, but I don't feel like marshmallowy at all.
I don't either, actually.
Yeah, so I'm going with the Malva as the woman's name because it's quite a common name.
Well, now, how did you get, first of all, you missed this dessert and you decided that in San Francisco, here where you're living, that everybody was being deprived by not having this experience. So you started making it?
Yes, you know, I actually started making it. I would make it at home because I just loved it. I started making it so I made it the way I wanted it to be. And then I'd make it every time I had people for a dinner. And I had a couple of people over that were like into the food business. So one had been executive chef at this fabulous restaurant. And he's like, this is really, honestly, I've eaten everything. It's one of the best things I've ever had. And I had a lot of other people just really encourage me to just try and do it. And I thought, you know, why don't I? Because I would buy it in the shop instead of make it. So I thought, perfect, I will just, let's see if I can do it. And I just started making it, took it to a couple of shops, and then it actually went very well. I said, well, let's do a demo and see if people like it. I had some samples, and we sold out in 2 hours. It was unbelievable response.
So now where is your market now? How far reach do you have? You just won, you were a finalist at the specialty food
Fancy Food Show.
Oh, yes, that was wonderful. Mm-hmm. So I am actually currently, I have quite a lot of interest on the East Coast, but we haven't tied up distribution at that point yet. There's so much involved in getting it to the stores. But pretty much I'm all over the West Coast at this point, and then it can be bought online, but I am currently working with a couple of customers out there who are very interested in carrying it there on the East Coast.
Okay.
New Jersey, New York.
Now, it's a little tricky because it arrives frozen, doesn't it?
Yeah, so when I ship it, it comes in like a styrofoam container, and I pack it either with dry ice or an ice pack. And it could just even be chilled. As long as it's just chilled, it's fine. Because at that point, it can be popped into your freezer again, or you can keep it in your fridge because it's good in your fridge for 2 weeks. It's quite an easy dessert. It's good in your fridge for 2 weeks, or you can even keep it out at room temperature as long as it's not like really, really hot, like as a regular cake for 3 days or so. And then otherwise I sell it frozen because it's freshly baked and frozen right away, and then it's good in your freezer, you know, 6 months to a year.
Can you explain what it tastes like and why it tastes so good?
I think it tastes, it's got this really fabulous comforting flavor that comes from, it's quite buttery and creamy, but a nice sweetness as well that just comes from the cane sugar, and it's got lovely cream and butter, which, you know, how can anything not taste good for cream, butter, and sugar? But it has a hint of apricot jam in it, and I think that just gives it this extra something. It just really tastes delicious. And a little vinegar, which is very South African. Vinegar's in everything.
Interviewed that man who makes the wonderful vinegars. What's it called?
Oh, I can't remember.
He's from South Africa.
He always wanted me to remember. It's Rosen something. It's Rosenbloom or Rosenberg or something like that.
Yeah, so the very nice vinegars that they're making there. Mm-hmm. And they've got the hibiscus vinegar and everything.
Now it's also got a wonderful texture thing. So there's a sort of a real wonderful density, comforting density when you get a spoonful and you put it in your mouth.
I know, it's yummy, I know.
So that's a part of the taste sensation as well. It's going to be a huge hit in the Northeast American winter, there's no question about that.
Yes, I know, I think so too, it's delicious, yeah.
Your story is on the website, right? Can you give us your website?
Oh, yes, so it's actually, I just did it, it's malvapudding.com, M-A-L-V-A-P-U-D-D-I-N-G, malvapudding.com.
How did it happen that these famous people that we mentioned at the beginning of the interview, how come they actually got some? Were Henry and Oprah visiting Nelson Mandela, is that what was going on?
Oh, that would have been nice, huh? So I think Nelson Mandela's always loved it. And then Oprah, when she set up her girls' school, she, South Africa, and they actually served that. She got her chef, Art Smith, to make it for their first Christmas dinner, which is nice because Christmas in South Africa is actually hot. It's the middle of summer. And the fact is it's like a good dessert because even though it's very comforting in winter months, you'd still eat it there in the middle of summer. Mm-hmm. And that was a big hit for their Christmas dinner. They had that with ice cream and it's just delicious. And so she's loved it. She's got a recipe for it on her website also. Yeah, and then we looked up a bit more, and then Henry Kissinger had been visiting, and he went to Bosch and Dahl and had the Malva pudding as well, and he was like, this is just unbelievable. You know, he loved it.
Uh-huh. Well, he's a European. Yeah. I mean, he's a European by extraction.
Yes.
So it's the kind of thing that would certainly appeal to him. It's because, you know, listeners, you, of course, if you think about your history and geography, remember that, in fact, South Africa was settled by not just one but two races of Europeans, both of who loved their puddings.
Absolutely.
Yes. Now, we just interviewed the guy, there's a guy in California who's marketing tequila, and we had rough time with his name because it was Dutch.
Oh, yes, it turned out his family was Afrikaans. And he's in San Francisco. He's the company called Partida Tequila.
Which is excellent tequila.
Nice.
Yeah, you could probably do a deal putting Partida Tequila with Malva pudding.
Right,
that'd be lovely. Yeah.
If you're interested, we'll put you in touch with them. You're in San Francisco?
Yes, just south in Santa Cruz.
Not so far away. So if when I think about it again, I'll put you in touch with him, and maybe you can see if you can do something together. It might be fun.
Oh, that'll be wonderful. Yeah, that'll be wonderful. Thank you. Yeah.
Carrie, all the success in the world to you, and you have a fine product, and I just am waiting for it to take off.
Oh, thank you very much. No, thank you very much, Anne.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, I'm looking forward to it. I think it'll be lovely. I'm looking forward to getting into the East Coast, into some stores up there, and I know it'll be a good success over there.
What did you do before you made pudding?
Before I did it, I was designing. Most of my expertise was actually designing clothes. So I was designing clothes. I designed swimwear for Adidas when I was in South Africa, when I went back when I was 21. And then, yeah, so I've been doing everything but pudding, you know. I've always liked dessert. I've always loved it. It's the one thing I could always cook was dessert, but never food, but dessert I could cook.
Well, you must keep in touch with us and let us know when it's going to be more widely available. Because
thank you.
Listeners, this is a good product to order in advance. It takes you a few days, but it's even better as a spontaneous purchase.
Yes. Yeah, no, it's really lovely. It's lovely, and it's easy, quick. It'll get there in a couple of days when I ship it.
Great.
Yeah.
Carrie, thank you again.
Thanks. Oh, you're welcome. Thank you very much. Thanks, Peter. Thanks, Anne.
Bye.
Okay. All right. Bye-bye.
And that's all for today's program. We'll be back reporting from Portland, Oregon next week, and till then,
bye-bye.